comments on the Ecclesiastes, Solomon's mournful autobiography. The book of Ecclesiastes was written by Solomon in his old age after he had fully proved that all the pleasures earth is able to give are empty and unsatisfying. He there shows us how impossible it is for the vanities of the world to meet the longings of the soul. His conclusion is that it is wisdom to enjoy with gratitude the good gifts of God and to do right, for all our works will be brought into judgment. Solomon's autobiography is a mournful one. He gives us the history of his search for happiness. He engaged in intellectual pursuits. He gratified his love for pleasure. He carried out his schemes of commercial enterprise. He was surrounded by the fascinating splendors of court life. All that the carnal heart could desire was at his command, yet he sums up his experience in the sad record. Ecclesiastes 1:14-2:11, quoted. Chapter 1, verses 13 and 14. Learning without God is foolishness. Solomon had great learning, but his wisdom was foolishness, for he did not know how to stand in moral independence, free from sin, and the strength of a character molded after the divine similitude. Solomon has told us the result of his research, his painstaking efforts, his persevering inquiry. He pronounces his wisdom altogether vanity. Review and Herald, April 5, 1906. Verse 14. All is vanity. Solomon sat upon a throne of ivory, the steps of which were solid gold, flanked by 6 golden lions. His eyes rested upon highly cultivated and beautiful gardens just before him. Those grounds were visions of loveliness arranged to resemble as far as possible the Garden of Eden. Choice trees and shrubs and flowers of every variety had been brought from foreign lands to beautify them. Birds of every variety of brilliant plumage flitted from tree to tree, making the air vocal with sweet songs. Youthful attendants, gorgeously dressed and decorated, waited to obey his slightest wish. Scenes of revelry, music, sports, and games were arranged for his diversion at an extravagant expenditure of money. But all this did not bring happiness to the king. He sat upon his magnificent throne, his frowning countenance dark with despair. Dissipation had left its impress upon his once fair and intellectual face. He was sadly changed from the youthful Solomon. His brow was furrowed with care and unhappiness, and he bore in every feature the unmistakable marks of sensual indulgence. His lips were prepared to break forth into reproaches at the slightest deviation from his wishes. His shattered nerves and wasted frame showed the result of violating nature's laws. He confessed to a wasted life, an unsuccessful chase after happiness. His is the mournful wail, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. It was customary for the Hebrews to eat but twice a day, their heartiest meal coming not far from the middle of the day. But the luxurious habits of the heathen had been engrafted into the nation, and the king and his princes were accustomed to extend their festivities far into the night. On the other hand, if the earlier part of the day was devoted to feasting and wine drinking, the officers and rulers of the kingdom were totally unfitted for their grave duties. Solomon was conscious of the evil growing out of the indulgence of perverted appetite, yet seemed powerless to work the required reformation. He was aware that physical strength, calm nerves, and sound morals can only be secured through temperance. He knew that gluttony leads to drunkenness, and that intemperance in any degree disqualifies a man for any office of trust. Gluttonous feasts and food taken into the stomach at untimely seasons leave an influence upon every fiber of the system, and the mind also is seriously affected by what we eat and drink. The life of Solomon teaches a lesson of warning not only to the youth, but also to those of mature age. We are apt to look upon men of experience as safe from the allurements of sinful pleasure, but still we often see those whose early life has been exemplary being led away by the fascinations of sin and sacrificing their God-given manhood for self-gratification. For a time, they vacillate between the promptings of principle and their inclination to pursue a forbidden course, but the current of evil finally proves too strong for their good resolutions, as in the case of the once wise and righteous king, Solomon. Dear reader, as you stand in imagination on the slopes of Moriah and look across the Kidron Valley upon those ruined pagan shrines, take the lesson of the repentant king home to your heart and be wise. Make God your trust. Turn your face resolutely against temptation. Vice is a costly indulgence. Its effects are fearful upon the constitution of those whom it does not speedily destroy. A dizzy head, loss of strength, loss of memory, derangements of the brain, heart, and lungs follow quickly upon such transgression of the rules of health and morality. Chapter 8, verse 11. God's long-suffering leads some to carelessness. In His dealings with the human race, God bears long with the impenitent. He uses His appointed agencies to call men to allegiance and offers them His full pardon if they will repent. But because God is long-suffering, men presume on His mercy. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. The patience and long-suffering of God, which should soften and subdue the soul, has an altogether different influence upon the careless and sinful. It leads them to cast off restraint and strengthens them in resistance. They think that the God who has borne so much from them will not heed their perversity. If we lived in a dispensation of immediate retribution, offenses against God would not occur so often. But though delayed, the punishment is nonetheless certain. There are limits even to the forbearance of God. The boundary of His long-suffering may be reached, and then He will surely punish. And when He does take up the case of the presumptuous sinner, He will not cease till He has made a full end. Very few realize the sinfulness of sin. They flatter themselves that God is too good to punish the offender, but the cases of Miriam, Aaron, David, and many others show that it is not a safe thing to sin against God in deed, in word, or even in thought. God is a being of infinite love and compassion, but He also declares Himself to be a consuming fire, even a jealous God. Review and Herald, August 14, 1900. Every offense set down for reckoning. The death of Christ was to be the convincing, everlasting argument that the law of God is as unchangeable as His throne. The agonies of the Garden of Gethsemane, the insult, the mockery, and abuse heaped upon God's dear Son, the horrors and ignominy of the crucifixion, furnish sufficient and thrilling demonstration that God's justice, when it punishes, does the work thoroughly. The fact that His own Son, the surety for man, was not spared is an argument that will stand to all eternity before saint and sinner, before the universe of God, to testify that He will not excuse the transgressor of His law. Every offense against the law, however minute, is set down in the reckoning, and when the sword of justice is taken in hand, it will do the work for impenitent transgressors that was done to the divine sufferer. Justice will strike, for God's hatred of sin is intense and overwhelming. Manuscript 58, 1897.